Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I should introduce us. You are Franco Pavoncello. Have I pronounced your last name or even
yes,
your first
correctly.
Name?
Yes, correctly. Franco Pavoncello, yes.
Actually, that sounded different from the way I did it. That sounded better. That sounded better. But thank you for being so generous.
My pleasure.
So you are a political scientist at the John Cabot University in Rome, and also, for that matter, you're president of the university, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yes. I wear these two hats, so to speak.
Okay.
So I do both things, yes.
Okay. So if the daughter I have who's in high school wants to go to the John Cabot University in Rome, and I want to pull some strings and get her in, you are the person I should be nice to for the next
Well, you know, this is this is where you can find me, basically.
Okay, I'm going to be as nice to you as possible. So, I guess the reason we're talking is because of this the Euro crisis. You've written about the Euro crisis. Actually, you wrote a piece earlier this year in the American Journal World Affairs.
Yes.
This is an ever-changing drama, it seems to me. I mean, earlier this week, there was near euphoria because of a story about how the world's central banks had coordinated to do something or other. And then the euphoria kind of subsided. And it seems to be a real roller coaster ride, and the stakes seem to be, can the Eurozone survive, and also kind of, can the world survive? I mean, not to over-dramatize it, but a lot of people think that you can imagine events in Europe that would drag the whole world into a serious economic tailspin.
Yes.
So I guess you are at an interesting place there. What does it feel like? I imagine this is just kind of dominates the news there, am I right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you can imagine. I mean, Italy has been under a very serious financial attack in the past several weeks. We've had a change of government, a rather repentine change of government, a swift one, a new technocratic government coming in. So you can imagine how important in the media this whole thing is, and obviously
can I just get you to explain that part, because that was a source of puzzlement to me a little bit. So Berlusconi, who was I guess just maybe the longest serving post-World War II prime minister or something, stepped down, as you just alluded to, and the way it happened was it seemed to be in exchange for Parliament passing austerity measures, which, the Germans and French were kind of demanding, I gather, in exchange for coming to Italy's aid. I mean, assuming I have that right, what I don't understand is why Berlusconi had to step down for that to happen.
Well, basically, the situation was that at some point the Berlusconi government could not communicate anymore the kind of confidence that the markets were expecting and that the rest of Europe was expecting. He just couldn't put together the measures that were necessary to reassure the markets. I mean, he just didn't have his coalition. Him as prime minister and his coalition in general did not really have the kind of political weight to just go into the society and to present measures that would be painful enough to solve the financial problems of Italy, but at the same time acceptable and to the society. The government just couldn't put it together, and at that point there was an increasing panic across the markets that Italy did not really have the leadership necessary to make these changes. But I think that what is even worse, there was a feeling that across the markets, what really sent the markets in a tailspin was the fact that Italy didn't seem capable of really getting rid of a government which looked more and more incapable of making these changes and in taking mm-hmm. substantial action. And it reached a point where something had to give, and as a matter of fact, when a legislation was passed without the minimal majority, it was passed simply because the rest of the of parliament did not show up for the vote, but Berlusconi didn't really have the necessary majority, which mm-hmm. meant that he couldn't really continue governing mm-hmm. in the near future, then he had to step down. And you know, but in a way, a lot of damage had been done in terms of raising questions across the markets mm-hmm. about the viability and the reliability of Italy. So,
but I mean, the will. This is what happened. But the will to pass these austerity measures that I guess Berlusconi couldn't get past did exist in Parliament, apparently, because they did it as soon as he stepped down, right? I mean, that's what I don't quite get. I mean, you had this technocratic government coming in, and I guess, I thought, well, if Parliament is willing to do this, why haven't they just done it? I mean, did they actively dislike the guy? Did they not want him to get credit for it? What is it, you know?
Well, I mean, first of all, it did succeed in getting those measures passed.
Yeah.
But you see, the problem was that you know, some of the, basically, it didn't really present it as measures. It presented it as a letter of intent to present to Europe. And basically, it didn't really have the support of the opposition. And mm-hmm. obviously, once he was removed, then both his own side and the opposition came very strong, rallying in favor of the, you know, Mario Monti, who took his place, mm-hmm. who is a technocrat, who is a professor of economics, mm-hmm. used to be a member of the commission in the European Union, mm-hmm. and obviously when he presented himself and asked for confidence, surprisingly, he got a Bulgarian support. He got 90% of the vote. So basically, here, both from the Berlusconi's camp, except mm-hmm. the Northern League that moved to the opposition, but also from the opposition, from what used to be the opposition to Berlusconi, i.e., the center left. Mm-hmm. So basically, here there is a strong feeling that the country wasn't really willing to undergo the sacrifices. And the markets were not really trusting that those sacrifices would be imposed on the country in the medium term, as long as that government was in power.
Okay.
But
and
once this new government came in, things changed very substantially.
And it sounds like, to some extent, the opposition demanded his stepping down as the price to pay for their support of the austerity regime.
Oh, that's for sure.
Okay.
But the problem is that if he had only been the opposition, mm-hmm. he probably would not have stepped down. What happened instead was that he really lost it financially in terms of the markets. They started selling mm-hmm. Italian bonds because they lost mm-hmm. confidence in this. And it reached a point where the spread between Italian bonds and the German Bund became so wide mm-hmm. that he couldn't take the pressure anymore. And the President of the Republic, Mr. Napolitano, hinted to him that if he really didn't show that he had a strong majority that he could rule with, he had mm-hmm. to step down. And he reached a point where, you know, he just couldn't go on anymore, and he resigned.
Okay, so I gather that there were two things about this that might have given more confidence to the European, you know, the European community about Italy's financial standing. One is the austerity package itself, and the other is that the guy who replaced Berlusconi had been at the European Central Bank, right? So now you had somebody in charge who was really on the same page, presumably. kind of as France and Germany, isn't in some sense? Is that
the
idea?
This is a very interesting thing. Mario Monti was not at the European Central Bank. He was a member of the Commission.
Okay.
He was
okay.
the Commissioner for Competition for 10 years. And as a matter of fact, he was supported both by the left and the right in Italy in that position. He was elected both by a center-left government and by Berlusconi himself.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what is very interesting here is this paradox where Italy, that while Berlusconi was still there, was really treated some kind of an argument for jokes. And there was this very embarrassing moment when Merkel and Sarkozy were giving a joint press conference, and they were asked if they trusted the Italian government, and they started laughing at each other.
That's not a good sign.
They had to say, no, we weren't really laughing or whatever, but you can imagine how embarrassing that was. But so suddenly we moved from a situation where this was the status of Italy, where suddenly with the arrival of Mario Monti, who is a well-regarded economist who has worked for Goldman Sachs, is on the Trilateral Commission, he was a commissioner, suddenly he started talking to Merkel and Sarkozy and interacting in a triangular fashion right away, and obviously he knows a lot more about the euro and from a technical point of view than either of them. So
right.
if you add to that the fact that there is another Mario who also happens to be Italian, who is Mario Draghi, who has become the governor of the European Central Bank, then suddenly you have these two Italians who have sort of jumped to positions of leadership in what appears to be a rather complex game on how to resolve this crisis. But what is important to understand is that Italy can play a really pivotal role, because Italy is not Greece.
Right.
If Italy fails, the euro will go.
Right.
I mean,
there is no way that a
country of these dimensions can collapse financially and the euro survive. So basically, what remains to be seen is how this country is going to pull itself up and pull itself together, and whether it's going to come out and make the kind of changes and reforms that are going to produce once again confidence in the markets.
And does that seem to be working so far? I mean, I assume the austerity package consists of things like higher taxes and lower benefits for people who are accustomed to receiving government benefits in one sense or another. Has the combination of the austerity package and the new prime minister who has closer links to kind of the European elite, has that combination seemed to take some pressure off of Italian bonds?
Well, you see, things are being put together. The maneuver is being put together, this plan.
Okay.
And it will be presented on December 5th.
Okay.
Now, the big problem of Italy, what we must understand is that the big problem of Italy is not really the deficit, the government deficit. As a matter of fact, the primary deficit, the primary accounts of government for Italy are positive. It becomes a deficit only if you include the interest that they have to pay on debt.
Okay.
The two big problems that Italy, actually three big problems that Italy had, were that Italy has a huge debt. It has 120% of the GDP in public debt. But the other very, very serious problem, which is the second leg of what Mr. Monti has to address, is that Italy hasn't really grown for the past 10 years. And this is a very serious problem, because the lack of growth, the negative or close to zero GDP growth creates all sorts of problems when you have to repay debt.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the second major issue that Mr. Monti has to address. And you see, they are doing this on the one hand by increasing taxes, by reintroducing probably a tax on the first home that was taken out by Mr. Berlusconi, by trying to fight tax evasion, which is really tremendous in this country. It's about 30% of the GDP and a very, very serious problem. But at the same time, what they really need to
do... Wait, 30% of GDP or 30% of the revenues that are supposed to be...
30% of the GDP.
Wait,
I mean, the black economy... The black economy.
I see. That percentage of the undeclared economy
is about 30%, and taxes are evaded accordingly, as you can imagine.
Okay.
So we are talking about a huge sum of money, billions of euros, that if brought back would really make a huge difference for the accounts of the state. I mean, you would have an immediate solution of the problem right there. The problem is that you're talking about, a vast tissue of small companies that don't declare taxes, that declare less than they should. Then you're talking about organized crime, crime in general, which is also a big chunk of all the money that is being exchanged. So they are introducing new measures to fight this phenomenon by... for instance, limiting the amount of money you can pay cash. They're thinking of reducing that amount of money to €200-€300. You can't pay more than €300 cash. You have to use some kind of plastic or checks or something that can be reconduced to the person who makes the payment. Now, at the same time that they're trying to increase their revenues, they really have to jumpstart the economy, and they are starting to think of many ways to do so by creating, by liberalizing the economy, by taking away all the various privileges and all the various obstacles to competition that exists in this country, because this is a country which has a tremendous lack of free competitive markets,
now,
which are really damaging.
Can I just say that this is a tension that exists in other countries, and certainly the United States, between, well, at least in the United States, it seems to be, these things seem to be in tension. On the one hand, addressing, in our case, it's a budget deficit, as well as a heavy debt. In your case, it's just debt, but in any event, solving that, tends to involve things like reducing government spending, increasing taxes. On the other hand, we need to stimulate the economy, which traditionally can be done more by reducing taxes and increasing government expenditures. And in the case of America, there seems to be kind of no way around that. I mean, maybe what you're saying is that in Italy, the economy is... so far from a true free market economy, in other words, is so constrained by maybe what a lot of people consider excessive regulation, that that you can resolve the paradox in a certain sense by just freeing up the economy. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think that you really hit the nail on the head, in the sense that the labor market is really blocked. In Italy, you cannot fire if you are in a company with more than 16 people. 16 people. You cannot fire. So basically,
you can't fire. Wait! You can't fire anyone ever, or
no? You can't lay off people. You can't lay off people with more than 16 people.
Wait. So once you're working at a company that has more than 16 people, you have guaranteed lifetime employment?
Yeah.
Oh, man, you guys have to change that.
After three months. And,
Franco, that's crazy. That's crazy. You have to change that.
That's very nice if you're looking for tenure.
Yeah, that's the only place. The only place in America, I think, that you get that is in universities. See,
well, I mean, but certainly not after 3 months, right?
Not after 3 months.
But
no.
This is the rule, and although things are changing, that is still very much the rule. And you see, what happens is that the young people who are outside, they don't really get a chance to get into the job market because
right.
who wants to hire? You know, once you're stuck for life, people are very reluctant to hire in a stable way. So you have these two large groups, those who are in, who are highly protected, mm-hmm. and then you have the young people who are working on all sorts of strange contracts which last 1 year, 2 years, then they're laid off, and then they have to look. And, you know, you can't really plan that way. You can't really plan a life. So
no.
people are saying it would be much more logical to create some kind of flexibility with some kind of social protection once you get fired and once you get laid off, because then the companies would find it much easier to hire because they know that if things don't work out, they can look
right.
for somebody else and you can move on.
Right.
So, but that is only one aspect. You know, then there are professional orders like the lawyers, the notary public. There are all sorts of constraints to enter professions. There are a lot of privileges in the Italian society of groups who enjoy those privileges. And this is really the central element of what we are seeing today in Italy. What we are seeing is that people are who kind of tolerated that situation because, after all, everybody was doing well and somehow, you know, getting along, has reached a point where people are saying, wait a second, politics too expensive,
mm-hmm.
politics is too inefficient, bureaucracies mm-hmm. is too inefficient, there are too many strings attached. Whenever you want to do something, you have a bureaucracy you have to deal with, you have a labor market which is very, very rigid.
Mm-hmm.
You have services that don't really function. And then in many areas, you have another big problem. There is a huge element of corruption, but you also have a very strong presence in many areas of organized crime. And
yeah, I've heard that about Italy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's not difficult to hear about that. But what happens at the end is that you don't really have foreign investment willing to go in and put money in. Also because civil justice is practically non-existent in the sense that it takes 10, 15 years to have, some kind of suit being resolved if you sue somebody
mm-hmm.
From a civil point of view for, you know, for some kind of damages. So there is really a feeling that this society has to be reinvented in a very serious way
and restructured. Are the current reforms they're talking about in Parliament, they really seriously address this stuff? I mean, there's a chance that people could lose this lifetime guarantee of employment?
Well, they're starting to talk about that. They're starting to introduce. They're starting to talk about introducing a new contract for young people that would give more flexibility, that would give them some kind of hope of a stable mm-hmm. employment. Obviously, the flexibility of the job place clashes with the trade unions that are very, very touchy when it comes to this.
Right.
Point.
I was going to say there must be significant opposition to this kind of reform.
I think that this specific issue will not be dealt on right now by the government, but
mm-hmm.
they will certainly deal with very important issues. Like, for instance, they will push up the pension age. They are thinking of pushing it up from 40 years to 41 or 42 years, and that will really have a very serious impact of several billion dollar euros on the budget. Plus,
what is the pension age right now?
Well, the pension age, you need to have 40 years of contributions. You have to be paying 40 years of contribution. Okay. And they're thinking of pushing it up to 41 or 42. And that obviously is generating a tremendous opposition among the workers, among the unions. But you see, the mood now is obviously because of the financial difficulties Italy's facing. I think that there is a very strong feeling in this country that Mr. Monti has to be given the possibility of enacting his plan, of implementing this plan, which is going to be hurting both sides of the spectrum. It's going to hurt the rich people because they are going to have to pay more taxes, but at the same time, it's also going to hurt the workers because, you know, their pension is going to come later. So there is a feeling that this plan that will be revealed on presented on the 5th will really hit both sides of the spectrum, and this might, at the end of the day, make it more palatable, more acceptable across the spectrum. So my personal feeling is that when it goes into Parliament, it will be approved by the majority of Parliament because simply because the alternative is bankruptcy for this country. You know, Italy is right now paying about 7.5% for 10-year bonds, and that is an unbearable level of rates of interest to pay. And I can only imagine what would happen if that government plan were not accepted. I mean, this is unthinkable. But at the same time, there is something deeper that is going on here. There is a feeling that this is a very important opportunity for Italy and for Italians to start anew with a new way of trying to build a state, a society that is fairer, that is more transparent, that is more efficient, and that really kicks in once again the kind of forces that produced growth in the 50s, in the 60s, when this was a very dynamic country, and which had a passion, a hunger that is not being felt right now. There has been this period for the past 20 years, and certainly since the entrance of Italy in the euro, there has been a period, in a way, in which I always say it feels like Italians went on vacation. They felt like, well, you know, we are now in the euro. They're going to make decisions in Frankfurt. We don't really have to worry about ourselves.
So you mean there's a sense in which the euro actually insulated you from the pressure to implement the kind of reforms you're talking about? I mean, was that just a psychological thing that people thought, oh, okay, the euro will take care of us? Or was there actually a material sense in which being in the eurozone, part of this unified currency, insulated you from economic forces that otherwise would have encouraged you to reform?
Well, let me first of all say that it wasn't just an Italian problem. It insulated everybody who entered the euro, from Greece to Portugal to Spain. And the issue is very simple. All of a sudden, Greece and Italy could borrow money at the same rate of Germans. So basically, you could go out and get money with a non-existent spread, non-existent difference in terms of interest rate, and you were given, you know, where you were using the euro as your currency.
Now, do you mean the governments could borrow money, or individual Italians could borrow money at the same rate?
Well, the banks could borrow money.
The banks could.
You know, the government could borrow money. The Italian's government could issue bonds, which are practically at the same value of the German bonds.
So, well, and yet, but that doesn't seem to be an inherent feature, because right now the interest on Italian bonds has gone up relative to German bonds, right?
Yeah, but that is exactly what I'm saying. After the arrival of the euro, there was a feeling, a generalized feeling, that what was happening in individual countries didn't really matter anymore,
right,
because they were running the euro in Frankfurt and they were running the monetary policy there. The problem was that individual governments were running their fiscal policy,
right,
and individual countries were controlling their financial institutions.
Right.
So what happened at the end of the day was that these financial institutions were lending money left and right, were creating bubbles, like for instance the housing bubble of Spain, or going into this craziness of lending money out and paying inflated salaries to government workers like Greece did. And all of a sudden, when after the crisis of liquidity, the subprime crisis of 2008, all of a sudden people started questioning this policy and started asking themselves, well, you know, are we going to give the same credibility that we give the Germans also to the Greeks or to the Spaniards or mm-hmm. to the Italians? And when they started looking at the accounts and the kind of debts and everything, well, and the kind of indebtedness of the banks and the mm-hmm. way the banks had given out money to finance and the suffering of the credits of the banks from the people they had given money to, well, the markets all of a sudden say, you know, gee, we are facing a tremendous crisis, monstrous crisis. We are thinking the unthinkable, that sovereign countries like Greece or Italy or Spain might actually fail,
so
like Argentina or Brazil or Russia.
So the interest rates between different countries only started to really appear, differences in interest rates that the governments could get on their bonds only started to appear in a significant way once people started to seriously think that kind of the whole thing could come apart, at least in the sense that, hey, maybe Europe won't step in to help an individual company make good on its obligations, right? And,
well,
previously the assumption had been that it was all for one and one for all.
Yeah, I mean, the feeling was that that the system didn't have the kind of fail-safe systems that could protect countries from getting in a situation where sovereign risk would appear. And just to give you an idea, only 3 months ago, the 10-year Italian bond was 4.5%. Now it's 7.5%.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see what the perception and psychological perception does. It almost doubled in 3 months.
Yeah. Now, there are some people who think that the only real solution, at least in the short term, is for the European Central Bank to act like America's central bank and, if necessary, just print as much currency as you have to print to address the interest rate problem. Have I got that right? That's one approach that people are advocating, and the Germans are resisting.
Well, that is one approach, in the sense that people are speaking about euro bonds and they're saying, you know, it doesn't make any sense if you have a single currency for Europe not to issue euro bonds that will cover everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that is part of the discussion, but equally important is what Chancellor Merkel has been saying, is before we start considering this kind of of money printing and euro bond responsibility for everybody, we need a much tighter fiscal union and fiscal control. And there are some
right.
very serious debates, in the sense
right.
that it's not really clear to the extent to what extent people want to go in a situation where the European Court of Justice tells individual national parliament how much debt they can produce or not.
Right. Now, when the currency union was started, in order to join, the nations were supposed to keep their debt to a certain level, and they were supposed to pledge to keep it at that level relative to GDP, I guess, or their deficits or something. There was some kind of fiscal mark that they needed to meet in order to join, and they were supposed to pledge to stay there. And then from the very beginning, they got a little lax, right? Like, if countries weren't actually quite there but were close, they kind of let some of them in. And you know, if countries adhered to that, there would be a sense in which, you know, their fiscal policy was subordinate to overarching European policy. But it's turned out to be the case, I gather, that countries just did not adhere to that pledge. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, there was the growth and stability law that basically assumed that countries should stick to the Maastricht criteria, which was basically 1.5% inflation, 3% deficit, and 60% debt. But the fact of the matter is that countries started going a little bit out of that, and the problem, and surprisingly, Mr. Monti told that at the conference he had with Merkel and Sarkozy, he basically told the Germans and the French that they had that problem, and they decided to look elsewhere when they had that specific problem, and that started creating problems.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, the fundamental problem here is also is not just that countries did not adhere to this criteria. Another very serious problem was that countries weren't looking at what the other banking systems in each other countries were doing and what fiscally the governments were doing. So you had a situation in which you really accumulated debt, and also banks were lending left and right and generated a tremendous amount of lending, which led to bubble. And when this thing collapsed, banks basically found themselves without money. Which mm-hmm. is exactly what the system addressed yesterday in terms of trying to solve mm-hmm. this tremendous crisis of liquidity that European banks face.
Okay, so let me make sure I've got the one issue clear. So the Germans are saying, look, if you want a European Central Bank that will bail you out by printing more money, you need to subordinate yourself to centralized European authority in another sense on the fiscal level, and give a centralized European authority, I guess, the power to actually, limit your own government's spending or dictate, you know, tax rates or something, right? Are the Germans actually putting it quite like that?
Yeah, well, basically, yes, and there is an argument going on these very days with France, in which the French are saying, well, you know, we're not really going to go for the European Court of Justice telling a national parliament what to do in that sense, because it would be too much of a loss of sovereignty. But, you know, what is interesting is that yesterday in Financial Times, a leading American economist came out and basically said that Italy has the task of saving Europe. How? Well, by ensuring that the government of Italy enacts those reforms that are going to reassure the markets,
mm-hmm.
and by reassuring the markets, bring down the tax, the interest rate
mm-hmm.
that they have to pay, and so in a way succeed in stabilizing somehow the situation without reaching the extreme where individual countries will lose their sovereignty
mm-hmm.
to some kind of European non-elected authority that tells elected parliament what to do. And
mm-hmm.
I think that this is a fundamental problem of what we are facing today, because obviously if the bottom line is going to be for parliaments and people to lose their sovereignty in order to make the euro survive, I think we're going to have a very serious problem here, because many
yeah.
people feel that a lot of Europeans are not ready for that.
Yep.
At the same time, I don't think that the Europeans are ready to take the baby and throw it away with the bath water, because you don't throw away 60 years of hard work in mm-hmm. building something that, in a way, was the redeeming factor for post-war Europe, especially for countries like Germany and to an extent Italy, that found themselves after the war not only with material devastation but also with a moral national devastation of values, and really looked at Europe as a way to resurrect the destruction of Nazism and fascism. And I don't think that people want to go in a situation where they throw away this architectural work that they've done and go back to the kind of nationalistic, protectionistic, mm-hmm. and very, very dangerous border customs war mm-hmm. that, you know, might appear once again yeah. once this single currency and the European Union are put on the demise.
Well, this leads to my final question, actually, and leads into it very directly. I mean, as you pointed out in the past, you know, the original, if you look at how the European Union evolved, you know, from the European coal and steel community, whatever it was called, right after World War II, to the European community, to the European Union, and ultimately a currency union, you know, from the beginning, the rationale, as you've noted, was not economic so much as political. The idea was, after World War II, how do we intertwine European countries so closely economically that they won't have another war? And yeah. I think you'd have to say it has largely succeeded, and what you've just expressed is the fear that if the whole European project does come unraveled, you could see a return to violent nationalism and so on. On the other hand, it seems to me that the European community, this problem we're talking about, is in some ways fostering international strife. I mean, for example, I'm sure that there are people in Italy who are saying, not only do we not like some of the austere reforms Parliament is talking about, we don't like the idea that they're really being imposed on us by foreigners, you know, by French or by Germans. I'm sure there's some of that kind of international tension. And then more broadly, what you know, we just said that we may be at a crossroads where either for the project to survive, it may mean, at least some people think it will have to mean, that individual nations actually sacrifice some of their policy, more of their policymaking sovereignty to a centralized Europe, and that, of course, will inevitably breed some resentment in these countries. That is, again, resentment against other nationalities, right? So, in a sense, isn't the project starting to foster some of the kinds of tensions that it was originally designed to subdue?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the kind of resentment to outside forces varies. I'm sure that if you were to look at a poll and ask that in Greece, you would have a lot more resentment than you have in Italy today, because Italians right now, I believe, are well aware in a very large way that a lot of the shortcomings were produced internally. Mm-hmm. But basically, the fact that you do have this kind of tensions created by these economic difficulties is really a vindication of what the founding fathers of the European Unions really wanted to do, which was to make sure that economic tensions and tensions of control of economic resources would not lead to the kind of bloodshed that we had in the first 50 years of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And you can see very clearly that already something as benign as what we are seeing today, because compared to what we saw in the 30s or 40s, this is right. benign in terms of economic you know, confrontation is generating animosity. So one can only imagine what would happen should this architecture fail and countries go back to the kind of disastrous customs war, and not to speak about the devaluation. Some people are predicting, should the euro collapse, a 60% devaluation for some of these countries.
Right.
I mean, the damage, the social damage being produced would be tremendous, and really would have tremendous consequences for involved.
Although I gather it is true, as long as we're talking about the 30s, that in Greece at least, and maybe in Italy, I don't know, the economic pressures, and I think to some extent the international resentments, have given some energy to fascist parties, right? At least in Greece, and isn't that right?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, certainly in Germany. I mean, Hitler was certainly the creature of
reparations. I mean now in Greece, you know.
You mean now in Greece?
Right.
Well, you see, this is surprisingly little, the reaction that you see. And in Italy, it's amazing. You don't really have it. All you have is the Northern League that has moved to the opposition, but you don't really have a movement in Italy that says, let's go nationalistic. Paradoxically, those movements, and maybe not paradoxically, understandably, you have much more of those movements in the rich countries that have to foot the bill, rather than in countries like Italy or Greece that are on the receiving end of all of this.
Well, that kind of makes sense. Just out of curiosity, I this really will be the final question. If the Northern League ever did succeed in seceding and creating their own nation within in Northern Italy, would it be their aspiration to remain a part of the European Union and part of the European currency?
Well, that's complex in the sense that they have changed their own opinion about that. At first they were pro-European, then they started raising some very serious questions.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, the chances of the Northern Union, of the Northern League succeeding in bringing the Padania, the area that they argue that is a national ethnic group, a very clear defined area, the chances that they have of succeeding from Italy are equal to the chances that New York City has of succeeding from the United States.
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen anytime soon. Okay, so it sounds like the good news from your point of view is whatever tensions have been created by this, they are arguments about policy, and that's different from bombing people, and that's better. And I guess you hold out some hope that's the way it's going to stay, and one way or another, they're going to keep the union together and the currency intact.
Yes. I believe that the euro is here to stay. I think that once you create something like this, it's very difficult to imagine a situation where this is going to unravel. People always talk about the difficulties of the euro, but they never really talk about the enormous success of this currency in Europe and how much every... You know, there are all these new generations that had never seen liras or drachma or whatever. They, you know, the euro is their currency. I mean, for older people it might look somewhat a change, but for these people it's unthinkable to go back to other types of currency. I believe that it will be a muddling through process. It will be a step after step without much clarity, but I just don't see how Europe is going to allow the euro to be demise, to go into a demise, and to have the European Union somehow hurt to the point of disappearing. It just doesn't look like a viable alternative, a realistic alternative for the crisis we are facing.
Okay. Well, I think I hope you're right, because the alternatives do all seem less attractive to me. And I think you're right. People don't, you know, they talk about the downside of the euro, which has suddenly materialized. But, you know, over the last couple decades, I think there have been a lot of economic efficiencies within Europe that people have taken for granted that were probably created by the euro. So we'll see. But thanks so much, Franco.
My pleasure.
Really valuable to have your perspective, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Paul.
Take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.